Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Standard Issue for all women.
Hello, Hannah here, and welcome to this week's Sunday Chops, in which I'm talking to author and journalist Hadley Freeman about her excellent book, Good Girls, A Story and Study of Anorexia. As you'll hear, Hadley developed anorexia as a teenager and was in and out of institutions for many years. And having read the book, it seems frankly amazing to me that she survived it. The book was released in hardback last year and was named as one of the best books of 2023 in The Times, The Guardian and The Wall Street Journal. And it's due to be released in paperback on April the 11th. So I grabbed the opportunity to chat with her about her experiences as a teenager and now as a mother of three. Anorexia remains terrifyingly hard for most of us to understand, but it's an issue that's not going away. In fact, according to the Royal College of Psychiatrists, hospital admissions for eating disorders have increased by 84% over the past 5 years. It's pretty rare to get a chance to read such an honest and informative first-hand account of a battle with anorexia, so this is a big recommend if you're looking to learn more. Just a reminder that if you don't already follow us wherever it is you get your podcasts, you should do that now. We've got some great interviews coming up, and that's the best way to make sure you don't miss any of them. Next week, for example, Mickey's talking to Sophie Williams about her book, The Glass Cliff. And in the next few weeks, we'll have interviews with Tanya Franks about her role in the new play, The Power of Sale, and to Andy Osho about series 2 of the BBC's Belfast set drama, Blue Lights. And Mickey's been to see Stranger Things, The First Shadow, and you can expect to hear an interview with its writer, Kate Treffery, soon. That's it from me. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Hadley, thank you so much for joining us. I finished your book last night. Totally fascinating. I don't even know where to start almost, so I thought I might start by telling you a story. This notorious family story that happened when I was about 3 or 4, and my dad came home from work to find that I was distraught. I said that my mum and her sister, my auntie Tina, were going on a diet, and I'd asked if I could go too, and they had said no. I didn't even know what a diet was, but I was just one of those kids who wanted to be involved. I don't know, maybe I thought it was some sort of aeroplane or something, but I'd been really put out. So obviously it's a funny story, kids are idiots, but I think also think it's an interesting story because it shows how openly my mum and my aunt were discussing how unhappy they were with their bodies in front of me, thinking it wouldn't go in, and it obviously did go in. Now, I grew up in 70s and 80s, so you're a bit younger than me. I was wondering if we could start by sort of painting a picture of what it was like for you growing up then. Not just within your family, but also, you know, the wider culture.
For sure. I mean, I think you're right, Hannah. I think also what's interesting about that story is that talking about diets is a form of female bonding. And, you know, that was something your mother and her sister were talking about together. And I think that is still true to a certain extent. I think it certainly was true in the 80s and 90s. I mean, I remember, you know, the women around me, whether it was my mom or teachers and stuff, talking about various diets. They were going on talking about it together. It was a kind of woman's lingo in the way that maybe more now women talk about where they bought their clothes. Oh, I love your coat. It's from Zara. I love your dress. It's from Boden, whatever. Women did use to talk about that all the time. And I remember watching movies. The main message I would get from pop culture in the 80s and 90s was that boys pursued girls. This was the message I got from every single movie I watched. All my favorite movies then, whether it was like Say Anything or Can't Buy Me Love or Pretty Woman, all these ridiculous rom-coms I grew up obsessed with, the woman just sort of stayed still and the man pursued her. And the tomboy friends were just there to encourage him. And so the lesson I learned was that girls are passive and boys are active. And that's a very sad message to grow up with. And it makes you really not want to grow up to be a teenage girl or a woman because you think, well, it's only as a child, as a kid, I get to do fun things and run around. once I'm a teenage girl or a woman, I just sort of stand there and look pretty. And that doesn't sound very fun.
Agreed. A bit like you, I was late developer. I didn't wear a bra till I was 15. I didn't have a period till I was 15. And I somehow inside my head had convinced myself this might not happen to me. I don't know how.
Yeah, for sure.
When it arrived all at once. And yeah, it was horrible. Everybody knows this, but it bears repeating. Suddenly men, actual fully grown men were commenting on the size of my tits.
Yeah.
When I was still 15. So yeah, I had kind of a complicated relationship with food. In fact, if anything though, I went the other way. I went, I really don't care.
Right.
I don't care what I look like. I'm quite happy to weigh what people would say too much.
Yeah.
In fact, I bought a pair of scales. The doctor told me I needed to lose some weight the other day and I bought a pair of scales. It was weird having them in my house. I was like, I wonder what my relationship with them is going to be now they're in my house. One of the doctors in your book says there's a genetic soil and then there are environmental triggers. And a lot of that genetic soil is about the idea that being female is just awful. it's just awful. So could you tell us a little bit more about what the other things in the genetic soil are?
Well, certainly a family history of eating disorders, which is very much the case in my family. My mom was anorexic when she was at university, and I have cousins on both my mother's and my father's side who had eating disorders. But whether that is in our genetics or whether that is something, you know, that's just kind of learned behavior is a controversial question. For me, I think it is learned behavior. I think some families learn to express unhappiness through alcohol. In some families, it's through aggression and fighting or whatever. Mine was very much through eating. And in terms of the other genetics, some people say that having a high metabolism makes a girl more likely to develop anorexia because she can lose weight very easily and therefore get the high of losing weight quicker. I don't know if that's true. And I knew girls in hospital who developed anorexia after going on a diet because they were told they were too fat by doctors. So it can go either way. In terms of the environmental factors, I think, you know, we all kind of know what they are, but it's not just about girls being told to look at their weight. It's girls being told that their body is the thing that people listen to most, more than their voices. And therefore, they learn that the way to express unhappiness and anger is through their body. No one wants to hear it when they say it. That's seen as ugly or unfeminine or crazy. You're one of those out of control girls. Like, nobody wants to be one of those. Whereas if you lose weight, then people will know that something's wrong. I think that is something that that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to write this book, is because people think that anorexia is just about a diet going too far or wanting to create moss. And the thing I really wanted to bring out is that anorexia is a way of a girl doesn't want to look thin, she wants to look sick. Because what she's trying to say is, I'm unhappy and I'm angry and I'm uncomfortable being a girl and don't want to be a woman.
Yeah. When I was 18, I made a new friend. She was 19. And I soon learned that she was in recovery, having been in hospital after suffering from anorexia. And I don't know at what point we should say that you no longer have anorexia. I don't know if people like the word suffering, but there it is. I've said
okay.
It. And what I found most interesting about it was that, as that other story probably shows, I was quite an aware child. I did pay attention to what was going on around me. And I knew lots of people that grew up in households that had problems in them. I mean, my dad was an alcoholic. I knew other people whose parents were alcoholics. I knew people whose parents were drug addicts. One of our next door neighbours, their dad was in prison. You know, I knew people who didn't even know who their dad was, or that their dad had died, or that their mum had died. One of the girls in my school, her mum was actually murdered by her stepfather.
Oh my God.
So with that as a backdrop, I was expecting, I can't really say too much because I haven't asked her if we can talk about this, but I was expecting when I met, let's call her Jane.
Sure.
I was expecting when I met Jane's parents to see something that explained it to me. And what I saw were two nice, maybe even like goes as far as to say boring middle-class people who love their daughter very much. And it totally blew my mind because there wasn't trauma. I was expecting trauma and reading, and I know now that that's wrong, but actually reading your book, that seems to be quite a common misconception. And
yeah,
actually, anorexia is not linked to trauma in a way that other mental illnesses or addictions can be.
That's right. There are obviously some cases of trauma. So the first friend I made in hospital, I can't remember what I call her in the book. I'll call her Sarah. her anorexia started in that she'd been sexually abused by her brother. And when she told their parents, they didn't believe her. And soon after that, her father and brother were killed in a car crash. I mean, like, you couldn't imagine more trauma than that. And then there was another girl in hospital, I think, in my last hospital, I think I call her Nora, and her anorexia was triggered when she was driving a car with her twin brother in the passenger seat, and there was a crash and her brother died. So, I mean, those are two horrible stories. But in the vast main, anorexia is a reaction to growing up as a girl and feeling that you are not able to articulate normal feelings of unhappiness, anxiety, and anger. It can also be, the reason it's quite common in, you know, what people say is middle-class families, although it's actually spread across the socioeconomic spectrum at this point, but nice middle-class families is because a lot of the time those families are very protective of their girls, and the girl gets the message that she is not able to cope on her own in the outside world, that the outside world is dangerous because her parents are so protective of her. And therefore, she becomes a little fearful of the outside world and then tries to stay a child to avoid it. That's a very common trajectory of anorexia. Other times, it is just fear of sex, fear of sexuality, fear of men staring at your chest like what you experienced, fear of leaving your mother, separating from your mother, a fear that your mother will be unhappy if you separate from her. All these very common feelings. And yet somewhere along the way, that girl has picked up the message from somewhere or just from herself that she is not allowed to say any of these things and that these are abnormal, disproportionate feelings that no one else feels and that she cannot cope with. And the only way to cope, therefore, is to not eat and try to stay a child as long as possible.
There's this terrible sort of irony at the middle of this, isn't there? That it's girls with anorexia, they feel desperately misunderstood, and yet it is so hard to understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
How can you, for loads of us, you know, for parents, for just the people around you, how can you understand that? I mean, I see some terrible stuff on social media of thinfluencers. Can't see what's driving that, and yet I know what it is, but it's when you actually see it, you know, in the flesh. The not flesh, I suppose. But actually, interestingly, hunger, and I was thinking about this when I was reading your book as well, hunger, you know, not eating, has another connotation in lots of cultures, like Irish culture, for example, you know, has a long, solid tradition of people starving themselves to death for political aims. And therefore, there is a glorification of it somewhere.
Absolutely.
There's so many complicated messages.
Oh, absolutely, which is why people sort of don't understand that anorexia is very similar to overeating, because overeating is seen as disgusting and not eating is seen as vaguely admirable, to be honest, and aspirational and also feminine, you know, to be entirely blunt. People who express unhappiness through their bodies do so by either undereating, overeating, or self-harm. And those are all three. I think I see them all as very similar. You know, people think of anorexia and bulimia as very closely linked. In fact, it's anorexia and binge eating that are very closely linked because bulimics tend to maintain a normal weight. Therefore, you cannot see that something's necessarily wrong by looking at them. Obviously, there are exceptions to that, but that is a general truth. Whereas anorexics are extremely underweight. Binge eaters are extremely overweight. Both of them are using their bodies to say they're unhappy to the outside world.
Now, I just said a couple of things and then said, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I said the right thing there. And, you know, probably better than anyone, Hadley, you can say things that will get you in all sorts of trouble.
Well, I feel like it's not a healthy society if we worry that a wrongly said word will get us in trouble. It's silly. Okay. We can all be understanding of each other.
Well, with that in mind, I did read something in your book that I found fascinating, but also I thought might lead to some potential backlash, which was actually about vegetarianism and veganism, which people feel incredibly strongly about. And I will say, my friend who had anorexia was a vegetarian.
Yeah, of course.
And they are really closely linked. That doesn't mean if your daughter turns vegetarian, you should worry that she's about to become an anorexia. But I wonder if you could explain why those two things are linked.
They are deeply linked, I think. So I became vegetarian when I was 4 years old. I told my mom, I asked my mom if chicken was actually like the chickens in the farmyard. And she said yes. And I said, well, I don't want to eat fish and meat. And she went along with it. She was a very nice, liberal New York mom. And just from that age onward, I then associated food with a sense of disgust and also didn't see food as something that was just there to fill me up and give me energy, but something to be conscious of, to think about maybe a little bit too deeply. And also, you know, cutting out food groups then became my identity. This was in the mid-80s. There weren't a lot of 7-year-old vegetarians around in 1985. So I became like that slightly tricky kid to have over for a play date. You know, we have to make Headley special. And so that was a real thing from an early age. And I see vegetarianism as my gateway drug to anorexia. You know, but the thing with vegetarianism is, yes, it can be a healthy way to eat. It can also be a very unhealthy way to eat, but it can be a very healthy way to eat. But it's also a legitimate way to start excluding food, which is why I do sort of prick my ears up a bit when I hear about someone's teenage daughter becoming vegetarian suddenly, or becoming a vegan, in particular, becoming a pescatarian. And the truth is, you know, I was only able to recover fully from anorexia in my late 30s by becoming basically a vegan, which sounds ridiculous, but it was only by, you know, finding a legitimate way to exclude food that I am able to maintain my weight. I still have this highly developed sense of disgust around food. And I'm not, you know, at all anorexic. Like, I have three children. I, you know, don't worry about what I'm eating when I go out. I eat ice cream, chocolate, all the rest of it. But that is still a part of me that needs to exclude food in some weird way. And it's now, I see it as just managing my weird attitude towards eating. It has nothing to do with calories or fatness anymore or anything like that. It's about controlling food. And I know that's wrong. And I wish there wasn't a part of me that was like that. But there is a part of me like that, and I manage it.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online, boom, which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
Tell me about being hungry. And I am absolutely no way saying that I had eating problems, because I don't think I did. But I can remember once getting on the school bus, and we lived about an hour away. It was about half an hour away, but you have to stop at like 40 bus stops so everyone can get off. So we were like the end of the line, and getting on, and one of my friends, we were about 14 or 15, saying to me, oh God, I'm really hungry, which meant if you were hungry when you get on the bus, you're going to be starving when you got off the bus. And I said to her, oh, that's a good thing. That means it's like, it's working. That means you're going to like start to lose weight. And looking at her and her being absolutely horrified by it, and me thinking, oh, I've said too much. I've revealed something there about myself. I've said too much. Now the idea of just being hungry makes me absolutely grumpy as hell, let alone the thought of being persistently unbelievably hungry.
It just becomes normal. Like, I used to have all these mind tricks I would tell myself about how to cope with it. Like, this isn't hunger, this is just how people feel. The purpose of the hunger is to distract yourself from other, even more uncomfortable feelings. You know, feelings of anxiety, feelings of loneliness, feelings of anger, feelings of desperation. So the anorexia is just a coping mechanism. It's like OCD. So instead of thinking about all these other unpleasant things that are scaring you, you can then just focus on not eating and how and obsessing over how many, you know, star jumps you did that day. In the same way, people with OCD focus on how many times they, you know, turned off the taps or did they turn off the oven or, you know, all those other kind of OCD thoughts that people have. And then, of course, your coping mechanism makes you more anxious because then you're thinking, I didn't cut out enough today. I didn't do enough exercise. So then becomes another source of anxiety. But you don't understand that. You think, I failed the anorexia. You don't realize that the anorexia is failing you.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Now, obviously, here you are, mother of three children, and you're writing books. There must have been a point at which it seemed impossible, at the very least for your parents, to believe that this would be the trajectory of your life. Mm-hmm. How representative do you think you are of girls that experience the experiences you've had in your teens?
Obviously, as Dr. Treasure says, my psychiatrist at the end, there is always hope. I think what's unusual in my case is that I was really very bad, and you know, the doctors did think I was going to die, and I was in hospital 9 times. And I think it is not that common to make such a full recovery as I have done, and that has nothing to do with me. A lot of it has to do with privilege that I have, which is that my parents were able to pay for me to stay in school, in the sense I had to leave the school I was at originally. I was a pupil of a special crammer in London, which helps kids who need to retake their GCSEs or whatever in a short amount of time. And the crammer, I did a 3-month GCSE course with them, and the crammer used to send me work. Now, this was obviously all private, so my parents had to pay for it. So I was able to keep up with my year. And then I did the same for my A-levels with a special 1-year crammar course and did my GCSEs in hospital and all the rest of it. Whereas all the other teenagers who were in hospital with me dropped out of school. And all the ones who I know of did not recover, are either still in and out of hospital or living with their parents or died. And I do think a lot of that is to do with the fact that I was able to keep a foot in the outside world. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. You know, the doctors in the 90s used to tell parents that their daughters had to drop out of school to focus entirely on their recovery. And for some reason, I didn't want to do that. And my parents agreed. And then the psychiatrist my parents eventually found for me also agreed. So that's why I was able to keep doing that. So when parents come to me and say, you know, my daughter's really ill or my daughter is in hospital, you know, what's the best thing I can do for her? I always, always say, try to keep some foot in the outside world for her. You know, even if she's not in school or whatever, just, you know, tell her what her friends are up to, what her sister's up to, you know, what's going on in your life. Don't collude with her in believing that the anorexia is the whole world. That is what the anorexia wants her to believe, but just keep reminding her there's more going on outside and that the world is continuing without her. That is the most important thing, I think.
Yeah, because you say something else really interesting in your book. And I know this to be true because, like I said, my dad was an alcoholic. You know, alcoholics have good days and bad days, or even if they don't have good days and bad days, they have a good morning and a bad afternoon, you know. And there are lots of other things that, you know, people who are bipolar have. They have good weeks and bad weeks, and anorexia, every day is a bad day.
It's true. And also every day, like when you're in recovery, you have to be doing the absolute one thing you don't want to do, you know. And this is not me, you know, in any way suggesting recovering from alcoholism is easy, because I know it's not. But it's not just that you don't drink as an alcoholic. Imagine, okay, alcoholics have to not drink when they're in recovery. Mm. But imagine they literally had to pour a tumbler whiskey, hold it there to their nose and not drink it and be surrounded by people who are drinking and a great time. And constant, well, I mean, they are surrounded by adverts telling them to drink and have a great time, but constant messages everywhere telling them the only way to have a happy life is to be drunk. I mean, that's what it's like to be in recovery from anorexia, and that you have to keep feeding yourself every day, 6 times a day when you're still trying to put on weight, 3 meals, 3 snacks, not exercise, all the while surrounded by people in the street who tell you, you look great now, you don't need to put on any more weight, I wish I was as thin as you, you could wear whatever you want. Actresses and models on screen who are thinner than you, and yet you're the one who has to put on weight. It is incredibly difficult. And this, I can't believe I'm even saying this cliche. What I say to girls is, you just keep faking it and you're going to make it. You just, you know, just keep eating. And at a certain point, it won't be the torture that it feels at the moment.
Now, you obviously, you are a success story. And again, in your book, there's something really interesting about sort of a lot of the ironies that take place. When you're first checked in to the first institution that you go to, they start checking you for things. Okay. And in checking you for things, they give you loads of ideas for how you can actually go about losing more weight.
Yep.
Again, I can't imagine any other circumstance where that is the case, that you are, you know, in trying to help, you can actually do more harm. And I think in several cases that in your book, there has been instances of that all over the place. Are things getting better? There you go. That's the question at the end of all that.
Well, so I only went back and visited the last hospital I was in, and things did seem better there. The girls all had more choice over what they could eat, which I think is really good. Rather than just forcing it on the girls, it makes it easier when you're back in the outside world to be able to decide what to eat for yourself if you've been doing that in hospital. But a lot of other things, no. And it's in terms of, you know, picking up bad habits in hospital, there is no way around that. Well, you have a ward of teenage girls and women, or put it this way, girls and women with eating disorders. They're going to swap tips. You know, that is what happens. So it was in hospital that I learned how to make myself sick. I learned about laxatives as a way to lose weight, although I never did it myself. Learned about self-harm and how to do that. Learned about how to sneak in exercise by just when you're sitting down. How to water load, which is drinking loads of water before the doctor weighs you so that it looks like you weigh more than you do, putting paperweights in your pockets, all that kind of thing. So there is no way around it. It's, you know, there's a very boarding school atmosphere on eating disorder wards in that it's full of girls and women who are there for hugely long stretches of time, you know, up to 6 months. Becomes very cliquey. It can be quite sort of backbitey. And what it mainly is, you know, when all of them sit around and talk about what they used to do and the foods that are good, the foods that are bad, you know, is in hospital, I learned that, you know, carbs are worse than calories, all that kind of stuff. That, you know, this is the stuff that we all talked about.
Now, obviously, women and girls are not the only people that have anorexia. You concentrate on they are the majority, and that's what this book is about.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could, firstly, I want to read something else out of this. I'll tell you about how I deal with life, that I haven't got post-it notes. I've got Rizzlers holding my pages open. But here we go. Here's a statement. Thinking too much about food is normal to too many women because it's how so many of us learn to express our feelings and judge ourselves.
Okay.
I mean, where do we even start in fixing that as a society? Come on, Hadley, fix it for us.
Well, I think that is a message I definitely did pick up from movies and TV shows growing up in the 80s. You know, someone's offered a piece of cake on screen. Oh, I shouldn't. Oh, so naughty. It's all that kind of thing. And yes, I picked it up from the way my mom talked with her friends when we go out for lunch. And I'm really careful. I make a million mistakes with my children every single day. They will have plenty to talk about in therapy in 30 years' time, I'm sure. But I am very careful never to associate food with morality and body shape with morality, and not to talk about it in relation to women, but not to men. I don't talk about it in relation at all. The only thing I ever say to my children about food is, you should eat that hamburger, it'll make you strong. I never say it'll make you big. You know, I never say, you know, ooh, you've eaten a lot or anything like that. Those messages we pick up from the culture around us, you know, that food is a reflection of who we are, when really it should just be fuel.
One more question on me expecting you to know all the answers to all the world's problems, Hadley. If there's anyone listening to this who they're much more likely to be the parent, but if they're not the parent, if they're just a carer, or if it's the person themselves, and if they're the parent of a boy and they're worried, what would be your best advice? Where would be your best starting place?
Well, the most obvious thing is to get professional help as soon as possible. It is too much for a parent to take on by themselves. It is too painful. And also, you don't want your relationship with your child to be just about food. And that inevitably becomes the case, because how can you think about anything else when your child is refusing to eat?
Yeah.
I know how difficult that is. I know how difficult it is to access help at this point. But try to, as much as you can, you know, get on those waiting lists, you know, harass your local authority, harass CAMHS. Some areas have really low wait times. I know other areas have very high wait times. And the other thing is, you know, what I said before, which is try not to make your relationship just about food. You know, try to do things with them that they liked doing before. If, you know, they were interested in, for example, fashion, you know, go to the John Singer Sargent exhibition, which has paintings of, you know, beautiful dresses. You know, if they were always interested in, for example, football, you know, go to a football game together, do things that remind them of who they are. Remember, once they have the anorexia, it's like they've got this evil sprite inside of them, is how I used to imagine it for myself. And the evil sprite wants to be all there is to you. and you've got to keep talking to the real person, you know, the original person. You know, don't forget that that's who they are, really, and help them remember who that person is by doing things with them, which is why I really try to separate the kind of anorexia recovery from the family life.
Yeah.
You know, into two different boxes, because what you don't want is the family life to be taken over by the anorexia.
Yeah, particularly because there, I mean, certainly in your experience, but in lots of people's experience, there are other children in the house.
Exactly. And it's so unfair on them. And my sister, my little sister, like, didn't speak to me until my mid-20s. And it took a long time for our relationship to recover because she was so angry with me that I'd basically ruined her teenage years, which was totally fair enough. You know, how unhappy I'd made our parents. And then I resented her as well for having had the fun teenage years that I didn't have. It was all very, you know, confused. We're very close in age. We're 15 months apart. And now, of course, we're very close again. But it's also just not good for the family life to be taken over by the anorexic. Not only for everybody in the family, but for the anorexic, because it's colluding in the idea that anorexia is everything. And also then makes her harder to recover because she's like, well, this is my role now within the family. It's very hard for her to get out of that then. Children are very susceptible to the roles that parents put on them. Whether it's, you know, you're the good girl, you're the math student, you're the athlete, or whatever. Suddenly you're the anorexic. It's like, well, then you keep performing in that role.
Yeah.
You know, don't collude with that. Remind her, no, you're actually the girl who loves movies and writing things and nature and all the rest of it. That's who you are. You're not this.
Thank you, Hadley. I got one more question for you. Given this is a very serious topic and there's loads of other topics that we could cover very seriously, the extra time, the question that I'm going to choose to ask you about is you were in it, but please tell me you watched the whole of that Colleen Rooney documentary.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, my God. Jen and I were obsessed by it. I was like, I can't believe I'm watching this. But yeah, I can't stop watching it. It was
Isn't it brilliant? Fascinating.
Yeah. I think you made some very insightful points about the way the media works. And actually, looking back, how shocking that was, how the media just followed her around as a 16-year-old girl.
What's so amazing, I think, is, and like, I know I sound like I'm her PR here, but like, considering how, you know, she has been watched since she was 16 and, you know, the horrible things she's had to go through in the spotlight, like we all know the various marriage issues and all that stuff. It is amazing. She's not totally mental.
Yeah.
Like, she is very, like, I've met her, you know, I'm not her best friend. I don't know what she does all the time, but she is just very nice and warm and so sharp in a way that I, in my, you know, snobby, glib assumption sort of way, really hadn't expected of her. And she is so hands-on with those boys, like way more than I am with my children. Like she, like when she came up to London for the interview that I did with her for the Sunday Times for the documentary, I said to her, you know, who's looking after the kids? And she's like, oh, my mom. You know, she doesn't really have childcare. It's her parents. And she'd laid out for the day the boy, all their different sports kits that they needed for school that day. I always forget which sports kit my kids need that day. She laid it all out, had them on the hangers, like unbelievable. Like how she's just someone with very strong working class family values. And that hasn't changed despite everything.
Yeah.
I think that's really amazing to have such a strong central core of who you are.
Well, I mean, as we've just discussed, coming from a nice, normal, untraumatic family is not a bar to normal teenage years, but it's a really good start. It is an unbelievably good start. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, she's definitely got really firm grounding. Her parents are over every day. You know, they're all very close to the boys. She goes to every single one of her boys' sports matches. Like I've got two boys and a girl. I miss my boys' sports matches. It was just like, how many football games can I go see in a week? Like, one is my limit. It's incredibly impressive. And those boys, her four boys, are very lucky to have her as a mom, is what I think.
Yeah. Thank you, Hadley. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Hannah. That was great.
Issue for all women.